Today, Friday, May 5th at 7.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. You don't have to be a conservative to love charter schools, but sometimes it helps. The charter that detaches any given school from the rules and regulations of government bureaucracy and also from the union contracts is a device that might cut costs. More important to market ideologues, charter schools are built on the choice of students, parents, and teachers whose only guarantee of survival rests on making the thing work. Charter schools are also fueled by a liberal dose of youthful idealism, as well as a kind of populist anger that the traditional public establishment is ignoring the needs of deserving kids. Our guest, Chester Finn, likes to compare the charter schools movement in America to Poland's Solidarity movement. Both of them stood up against an entrenched regime. Chester Finn has been a big booster of charter schools for a long time. He worked in Ronald Reagan's education department in the mid-80s. He's written a new book called Charter Schools in Action. It's a kind of report card that looks at 100 charter schools across the country. Chester Finn is the visionary. Our guest in the studio, Michael Goldstein, is in the trenches. He is starting up one of Massachusetts's many new charter schools. His will be the Media and Technology School. Connection listeners, 7 years into this charter experiment, how are they doing? And how do you measure their results? Does it say anything that they're not doing noticeably better on standardized tests compared with the balance of public schools? Connection listeners, do you have any advice for Michael Goldstein? Would you like to teach in his school? 1-800-423-8255 makes the charter school connection. And I suppose the underlying question, connection listeners, is the blue may be a little bit off this rose, but are charter schools still a good idea? 1-800-423-TALK. Chester Finn.
Yes, sir.
You've been an enthusiast and a critic, and you've done a sort of inspector general's report on charter schools. What are the main conclusions?
Well, it's nice to be with you this morning. We are pretty bullish about charter schools as a very exciting and promising reform strategy for American elementary secondary education. They are surging around the country. We're up to 1,700 of them right now, enrolling about 350,000 kids. I believe 38 states have now authorized charter schools to come into existence. And in a few places, they're beginning to be a non-trivial fraction of what's going on in education. Here in the District of Columbia, where I'm sitting at the moment, for example, 10% of all the kids in D.C. are enrolled in 28 charter schools this year. And in Kansas City, Missouri, I understand they're up to 13% of all the kids in the city in charter schools this year. This suggests one of the things that we actually found in our research, which is that the demand is keen. The popularity among parents and students and, incidentally, teachers is very high. The appetite for more of them exceeds the supply. In almost every place where there's either a waiting list for the individual school, more kids would like to go there, or there's a waiting list of people who would like to start these schools, usually bumping up against the cap that the state legislature imposed for political reasons. We cannot yet answer the big question, which is academic achievement. We just don't have the data, and the schools are too new. The average charter school in America today is less than 3 years old, and I think it'd be premature to try to pass any kind of final judgment. But as a promising move toward a whole new form of public education, and let me underscore that these are a new form of public schooling, my colleagues and I think this is a pretty promising thing.
Well, all the more, I'd invite connection listeners anywhere to, if the judgment cannot be made on the basis of standardized measures of academic achievement, I'd love to know what parents of kids in charter schools make of this experience in maybe a little less objective fashion. I'd also like to just ask you in a very general way, Chester Finn, if you walked into a public school in America today without knowing charter or public or standard public, how would you begin to look for clues that would identify the difference?
Well, you'll find some overlap. They're not night and day differences. There are some conventional public schools with some of the attributes of charter schools and vice versa. And I sure would not sit here and tell you that every charter school in America is a terrific school. because I've been in some that I wouldn't send a child I disliked to. But you'd first look and see, is this a big school or a little school? The average charter school has about 180 kids in it. It is much smaller than the average public school. Secondly, you'd look and see whether you are surrounded by people who are going about their day's work, and I'm talking kids and adults alike, with a sense of purpose and mission, because people in charter schools generally signed up for the mission, and they're generally in the school because they wanted to be there, not because somebody assigned them there against their will. And then you might look around you to see what the condition of the physical facility is, because in most cases, charter schools are occupying much more makeshift and ramshackle facilities than traditional public schools, because state charter laws typically do not give them any capital funding at all, and usually shortchange them on the operating dollars as well, meaning that a lot of charter schools are operating in temporary classrooms and storefronts and warehouses and church basements.
That's interesting. Any more measures of happiness? How about length of the day? How about size of classroom? How about engagement of parents?
Engagement of parents is nearly universal in charter schools. There's a handful of exceptions. They would mostly involve the charter schools that specialize in former high school dropouts, for example, whose parents you might not see on hand. But charter schools with an elementary or middle school population, you will see a lot of parent engagement, a lot of parents in and out, a lot of parent volunteering, a lot of communication with parents. You'll find in charter schools, the best measure right now probably is the eagerness of people to put and keep their kids in them, the sort of marketplace measure. It's not that there are no test scores. It's just that they're very early, they're very preliminary, and they tend to be state-specific. That is, you can see scores for Colorado, but you can't compare them with scores in Massachusetts, for example. But these softer indicators of, is this something people want for their kid? And you got to put yourself in the place of a parent and say, who's going to send their kid to a brand new school in a ramshackle facility that has no track record? You got to be kind of desperate to be willing to take that chance. And it is no coincidence that charter schools enroll a whole lot of poor and minority families from inner city situations and kids who have had a real tough and unhappy experiences in other schools, and their families actually are desperate to find a place that's going to care about their kid, that's going to be safe, that's going to focus in most cases on important basic curriculum components. The fact that people are willing to take this chance, I think, is the best measure there is of how unhappy they are, at least those 350,000 kids, with the traditional offerings.
Speaking of taking a chance, I want to introduce Michael Goldstein, who came from New York to the Kennedy School substantially to figure out how he might build up his own charter school. What kind of school do you have in mind, Michael, and what in the world made you think you could build it?
Well, I think we started with the desire to create a small school that really took this idea of media and technology. Every school is spending a ton of dough on it. I was very interested in, if you were starting from scratch, in the same way that companies do now, companies like Cisco, if you were starting something from scratch, how could you really use these different tools to make day-to-day learning work better? But what's attractive about charter schools is that you're free of a lot of red tape. You get to trade in exchange for the accountability that's put upon you. You have a lot of flexibility to make decisions. And probably the most important piece of that is being able to choose your team, to hire whomever you see fit, to use volunteers in whatever capacity you see fit, and to really try to create what's more of, and this is something that Mr. Finn writes about in his book, to create a small family. It's interesting. When we recruited for kids, we open in September, and we have 80 ninth graders starting, and we have about 180 students now on our waiting list. I think it does speak to that desperation.
Seats for 90 and 180 on your waiting list, how do they know about it? And then what are they expecting?
They know about it primarily through visits to middle schools and talking to kids about what our school will be like and visiting neighborhoods, libraries, YMCAs, and telling parents about what our school will be like. It's interesting. Parents respond to small. They respond to safe. They respond to somebody who's going to know their kid. Kids respond to specifically, what is your school going to be like? And I think it's interesting with our group, some of the kids were driving the decision about where they would go to high school, and some of the parents were deciding or driving that decision. Kids were responding to what our offer was to them, which is essentially, look, you're going to have to work a lot harder at our school, because to legitimately prepare you to go to college, you need tons of work in math and writing and reading and science. But what we'll exchange is we will make the everyday school situation much more interesting. And whether we can deliver our promise to them or whether they will deliver their promise to us remains to be seen when we open.
The phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're taking a further look at the whole charter school idea, which has been a very attractive option and a bit of a legislative fight in Massachusetts for the last 6 or 8 years. A lot of these schools are up and at it for years now, some of them ready indeed to be tested. The interesting news, and I don't know that we've really accounted for it in Massachusetts yet, Chuck or Finn, is that on the so-called MCAS, Objective Test of Achievement, the charter schools are negligibly different from anybody else. Is this because the tests are bad, because the schools at the end of the day aren't really very different, or because we're just missing the point entirely?
The schools are all over the map. Some of them are traditional schools. Some of them are progressive schools. Some of them are core knowledge schools. Some of them are, frankly, a little bit flaky in terms of their curriculum. What they are drawing are a lot of kids who were really not doing well in their other schools. And it used to be that you'd hear the so-called level playing field argument from the people in the public school establishment, saying that the charter schools will get the lucky kids, the good kids, the motivated kids, and we in the traditional schools will be left with the kids who are doing badly. There's some evidence that just the opposite is actually occurring, that the kids who are flocking to charter schools are kids whose families are indeed desperate because their kid really has not done well or indeed has even dropped out of traditional schools. So we're beginning to hear charter principals and charter board members saying, you know, the playing field is not level, and it's tilting in the opposite direction from that which the public school folks were complaining about. I think that, in fairness, we've got to give a school about 5 years to judge whether it's effective academically with its students. You can be surer sooner with first graders, of course. If you start with ninth grade, which is incidentally a pretty gutsy thing for Michael and his colleagues to be doing, you're going to have kids, some of whom have been badly wounded by the previous 8 or 9 years of educational experience, and some of whom are way behind where they should be. You can't expect the MCAS or anybody else's test to show huge gains all of a sudden. You got to give this a little time.
This makes a lot of sense, though, the idea that charter schools wouldn't be skimming off the cream at the top. They might, in fact, be getting the kids who had real bad educational experience. That's the way it works with rich families, too. Their children stay in public school until something goes wrong, forcing the parents to get involved and maybe to send them off to northern New England someplace where somebody else will give them special attention. But these are, in a certain way, disadvantaged kids. Can the charter school movement live with that kind of school population and thrive, Chuck or Finn?
Well, certainly the case that people who are satisfied with their kids' education in the school that they're presently in are not likely to move their kid to any school,
right,
be it public, private, or charter. I think it's politically very important that charter schools serve at least their fair share of poor and minority kids, and they're certainly doing so today. I think this would be a political dead letter if they got the reputation of serving privileged and wealthy and highly successful kids. Then they would be accused of skimming. But actually, just the opposite is happening. We're seeing something more like skim milk than we are like cream in terms of who is entering many of these schools in many parts of the country. I think that the test will be whether the value that a charter school can add to these kids, the sort of gain score in the course of a year, let's say, is bigger than the gain score of similar kids in traditional or ordinary schools. And that's the kind of research that needs to be done. I think we don't know the answer to it yet.
We're looking at charter schools this hour with Chester Finn, who's been in on the movement from the beginning, and Michael Goldstein, who is setting forth to open his own media and technology charter school somewhere near Boston this September. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone, especially for parents or people or kids, for that matter, who've had some experience in the charter school movement. 1-800-423-TALK. Amy is on the line.
Hi.
Hello,
Hi,
Amy.
I taught for 3 years at a charter school in Lowell, Massachusetts.
In Lowell?
Yes, the Middlesex Academy Charter School.
Okay.
Mr. Finn may be familiar with it, I'm not sure. And I want to really report a mixed picture. I taught for the first 3 years of the school. It's a small school of about 100 students geared toward at-risk high school students. And I think in some ways we created a wonderful, wonderful school for those kids. Many of them had an education experience at our charter school that was a million times better than what they'd ever had before. And many of them made great strides. And in a community where there's a lot of gang issues, we created an extremely safe space and a respectful space. And academically, too, I think many of the kids made tremendous strides. But on the other hand, I really think it's important to say that a lot of what made that possible isn't necessarily what's going to be able to be replicated generally. For example, the small size of the school made a huge difference. And I think we have to consider that seriously in terms of public education. I mean, our Lowell High could not do what we were doing, you know, for 100 students. And so are we going to split Lowell High up into, you know, 12, you know, or 15 schools of 100 students each? Maybe that's what needs to happen. But if that did, maybe Lowell High could be doing the same things that we were doing. Another issue is that I think there was a real kind of like a newness effect because we were a new school. I was part of the original team of four teachers that was hired to start the school. And there's that's incredibly energizing to be part of something new like that. And I don't know if that is going to be sustained. For example, I think that I really saw, even as there was started to be some staff turnover in the third year that I was there, you could sort of see, not to put anyone down, but you could sort of see that there wasn't quite that same sense of like zeal and commitment that there might have been right at the beginning.
Mm.
So as these schools keep going, I don't know if that effect is going to remain. And the last point I wanted to make is that I think a lot of the support for charter schools has to do with a real anti-union thing on a lot of, you know, that teachers' unions are what's responsible for ruining public schools. And I want to say that as a teacher in a charter school, I would have very much appreciated having a union. There were real issues, personnel issues there that we didn't have good ways to deal with. We had the director of the school, who since has been forced to leave, was pretty abusive to staff, and that, you know, there wasn't really a viable way to deal with that because we didn't have a union. And so I really want to sort of strongly, as someone who taught in a charter school, I really want to strongly say that unions aren't the boogeyman here, and that charter school teachers may need unions as much as anyone else.
Could you have given the teachers in Middlesex and Lowell union protection in terms of abuse, not to mention wages, without bringing the union in to run the hours of the school, for example, or say when you can teach and when you can't teach?
Well, sure, absolutely. But every union contract is negotiable. You know what I mean? Those are issues that any union contract can include or not include, depending on the parties who negotiate it. So,
what would have been the good minimum basis of a union agreement with that charter school? What would you put in it?
Well, there would have had to be grievance procedures. I mean, that was the issue. We had a school that had been founded and was run by a very dominant person who made it impossible to really bring any grievances about things that were going on in the school, and who sort of created an atmosphere of paranoia. And in a school where there's a union and where there are, you know, set grievance procedures, that wouldn't necessarily have been the case. And in addition, the reasons why the things that were happening, which I won't go into, which why she was eventually forced out, might have come to light much sooner. Mm.
Michael Goldstein, I wonder, Amy sounds something like you 3 or 4 years ago. Does she have useful lessons for you?
Well, I sound like the principal who's going to be forced out after a couple of years, the megalomaniac.
Well, these were very specific issues.
but, yeah, there are a few important lessons. One is, I wonder, you know, Tom Paysant and the Boston Public School System right now is trying to come to an agreement with the teachers' union for the right to have principals hire teachers as they see fit
right.
for openings in their school.
Right.
The union has indicated they're not going to let that happen. That's, to me, the most important piece of a charter school is the ability to recruit and attract and kind of maintain terrific teachers,
right,
and not to have that based on how old or how many years of experience they have. Is that something that was important at your school? And is that something that you would give up, I guess, to have the union in a school?
I think it was something that was very important at the school, although I also have to say that the kinds of issues that we weren't able to deal with well because partially of the absence of a union were issues that really wore people down. The school started with some terrific staff, and people got worn down, and partly due to the lack of a union through which they could have dealt with grievances. And that can happen to anybody. So I think that on the one hand, yes, the opportunity for the principal to make those choices. And I don't know enough about sort of the politics of a large union like the Boston Public School, so I shouldn't really speak to that. I don't know.
Amy, have you got a sort of little handful of suggestions for Michael starting out?
Listen to your teachers and maintain a small size. I think some of the charter schools seem to have outgrown. You know, I think the small size was probably the single most important factor in allowing our school to do what it did. And so maintain that. And give your teachers opportunities to kind of maintain their professional enthusiasm.
Amy, let me ask you this. We're actually going to be the smallest public high school in Boston. We're going to max out at 160 kids.
Mm-hmm.
But during that first year when it's crazy and it's frenetic and things are going crazy and parents are calling up and kids are trying to figure out what they're doing, what were the things during the first year, I guess the best pieces of what was happening there, that people did to support teachers, or what could they have done?
We're asking questions this hour about charter schools, new and old, and in Michael Goldstein's case, not yet born. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston.
I think that, I guess that raises another issue, which is I think that the success of a lot of charter schools, and not just charter schools, but other, for example, we were part of a national network of middle colleges, which are high schools based at community colleges, many of which were not necessarily charter schools, but they were all small kind of pilot or alternative schools for gearing themselves toward at-risk youth. And a lot of those, oh, I just lost my train of thought there.
I was just going to suggest that Amy's initial point about the lessons that charter schools can teach the system as a whole oughtn't to be forgotten.
Well, what I was going to say is I think there are serious issues of burnout, and I hope I'm not just speaking about myself. I mean, I had personal reasons for leaving. I had a baby and so forth. But I think that part of what is instrumental to the success of these schools is the fact that the staff are willing to go way, way, way above and beyond. I mean, I would hate to try to quantify the average number of hours per week that I and the other teachers work there. I mean, it was probably 70.
Exactly what drives the union around the bend.
But it's not just an issue of driving the union around the bend. It's an issue of the fact that union or no union, that's not sustainable. You're not going to have you can have people doing that for a year or two at the beginning when it's a new thing and it's really exciting and everybody's geared up. But it's not a sustainable arrangement for the best teachers. And I think we need to think about how we can kind of spread the work so that teachers aren't put into that bind where you can work in a really exceptional school environment, but only if you're willing to work 70 or 80 hours a week.
Justin, what do we learn on this subject? The original promise was the teachers would be paid more, somewhat more, for suspending the work hour limitations, that they would also be investing more passion, having more fun, being the best teachers they could be. But as Amy says, there is a inevitable limit to that kind of output, burnout or otherwise. How does it get resolved?
Most charters in America, upwards of 2/3 of them, are new schools. They are analogous to startups in any field of work. The other 30% are conversions of existing public or sometimes private schools into charter status. And any startup in any line of work is a crazy round-the-clock experience at the beginning, whether it's business or education. And the people who go into it at the beginning have to expect to work around the clock at the beginning, and they usually are not well compensated at the beginning for that round-the-clock experience. But there's an excitement, and there's a mission, and there's a zeal that usually helps to make up for it. Most startups then level off in some way. They stabilize. Our experience with charter schools is that they work through horrendous startup problems, and then there's often personnel turnovers, and they often then stabilize. It's never sort of smoothly bureaucratic like with the big traditional schools, but they're still vulnerable to things like a personnel shift that makes an abrupt change in the life of the school. But there are enough 4- and 5- and 6-year charter schools around the country now, including some in Massachusetts, by the way, that have already had their charters renewed, that you can begin to see that these can stabilize into something more akin to a normal school. Now, that does not mean a 6-hour day and 180-day year like most of the traditional public schools. Typical charter school continues to be a place where people do a lot more work than, or at least a lot more hours. And the average pay, incidentally, for staff in charter schools seems to be almost exactly the same as the average pay for staff in regular public schools, mm-hmm. and they do work more hours for that money. It's made up to them. We learn a lot about teacher motivation here. Money's part of it, but so is collegiality and a sense of mission and students who want to be there.
Okay. You say it can come to be sustainable. Let's take a short break. We're talking about charter schools on The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
287.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about charter schools as the charter school movement hits a kind of cruising speed, whatever that speed is. Chester Finn has been a charter school plugger from the beginning. Michael Goldstein is going to start a new charter school around Boston this fall if he can find the space. You got some real estate shopping to do, Michael, but you've also heard some warnings from people who've been at it so far that there are problems of burnout, there are problems of just coming up with the scratch to give teachers the extra pay that justifies longer hours. There's a question of unions and unionization of these teachers lurking in the background, too. Are these the kinds of things you worry about, or do you have bigger things still?
Well, the biggest fish to fry when you're starting a brand new school is you need a place for the kids and teachers to come together. And
have you got yours?
We don't have ours.
What do you need?
We need about 16,000 square feet of space. Charter schools are, as Mr. Finn said, sometimes in church basements, sometimes in office space, sometimes in converted warehouses. One of the things that could be really helpful is the state is now debating, the state house in Massachusetts, a provision to provide the same capital assistance to charter schools as they do to all the public schools.
Capital assistance as well as the per head.
Right. Our main funding comes from a per pupil allowance. We get about $8,500 per student per year, and we expect to spend more like $12,000 per student per year, and we'll raise the rest of the money privately. But in addition, there's money available for building a new building or renovating an old building. And, you know, I was listening to your show yesterday and the dot-com craziness. One of the interesting things that's good for us is it's created a lot of wealth and some people that are very interested in education and willing to give. One of the downsides for us is they've vacuumed up all the available real estate in Boston, and there is just very little vacancy. And it makes it hard for us and for all the charter schools in Boston and in many urban cities to find space. On the burnout side, I think it's such an important point, and it's something that you do see in some charter schools, but you see it in every single school, every single public school. You know, the dropout rate of teachers, especially in urban schools, in the first couple years of teaching is huge. At least half the teachers leave teaching entirely after
so
the first
just,
few
you,
years.
Do you just learn to replace them, or is the way to cope with burnout and to stretch these careers?
I think there's a way, but there's also a selection bias. The stack of resumes that I have on my desk from teacher candidates, I must say, are people that every indication seems to be they're workaholics. They're people that already in every school that they work at, whether it's an independent school, a private school, a public school, a suburban school, they all work. They bring work home to, you know, they work on the weekends. They're always marking papers. They're always creating lesson plans. They're thinking in the summer about their kids. And all those people are looking for places where they can be around other teachers like them. I guess that's the best thing that a charter school could provide.
The phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about charter schools 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the line. On the occasion of Chester Finn's book, reviewing a whole lot of them around the country, it's called Charter Schools in Action. 1-800-423-8255, the Charter School Connection. Anna is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Anna.
Hi, I've got a child in kindergarten at the Somerville Charter School, and we are going to take him out of there for first grade. We're not really thrilled with it. I'm not thrilled particularly with their approach to discipline, and I'm not really that impressed with the academics either, quite frankly.
What is their approach to discipline, and what are their academics like?
I think, you know, I respect structure and discipline. Kids definitely need to know what the limits are, but I think it's a little bit mindless and sort of a B.F. Skinner approach. You know, it's like there's school uniforms, there's a chart on the wall of little cards they get for doing good deeds and all this sort of things, and if they do a misdeed, there's all sorts of, you know, color-coded graphics on the wall to indicate, you know, where they are in the scheme of things. And some of the kids have been treated very insensitively, you know. It's not that you expect your, you know, individual kids to get a lot of special treatment, but there's some kids there who are really struggling, who keep ending up being sent to the principal's office or getting these sort of humiliating stickers for infractions that are really small in the scheme of things. And I don't think it's the best preparation for adult life if you get into trouble for speaking out of turn. You know, one child said, oh, I understand, and, you know, he was sent to the principal's office, you know, because...
I wonder, Chester Finn, is that kind of old-fashioned discipline typical of charter schools, or is that the mark of one school, would you say?
It's one school. The schools as a group are extremely mixed with respect to their philosophy, their discipline, their pedagogy, their approach to kids and families. But let me just underscore that the basic argument for school choice and for charter schools is that people should be able to make changes. If they are in a school that doesn't suit them or their kid, they should be able to go to one that suits them better. Our son went to, I think, 5 different schools between kindergarten and the end of high school. We were exercising choice. It's a good thing to exercise. What charter schools give are options for families who might not be able to afford the private school option or be able to readily move to another community in search of a different public school.
Anna, you said you weren't crazy about their academic plan either. What was that about?
Well, I guess their approach to teaching. You know, for example, you know, I think on the second day of kindergarten, the teacher called me in to have a little chat, and she said, you know, we're kind of concerned about your son. He colors very slowly. He really kind of takes his time. And I'm like, why is that a problem? You know, I mean, to me that indicates, you know, thinking. They had this sort of lesson plan that was called Letterland, where they were teaching children how to read using these cartoon characters to represent letters of the alphabet. And she said to Jack, you know, draw an A. And so he drew the letter A, and she said, that's not right. I mean, Annie Apple, like he was supposed to draw this little weird cartoon character. And I'm like, it was just very confusing. And it just seemed unnecessary and silly. And I think that, I don't know if this is the uniform plan, but there were just things that just don't sit right. It hasn't been a completely horrible experience, but, you know, I was just hoping for something a little more thoughtful.
Anna, that's interesting. Who was running that school?
Someone who left in a hurry. I don't know.
Okay.
There was a quick resignation, and I think there are some political issues going on with the
was
charter
it a
school Sabus, in Somerville.
Sabus School?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
See, Sabus is an international firm that's running about 15 schools around the world, some of them charter schools in the U.S., and they've had a pretty good track record in a lot of places, but not everyone agrees with their philosophy.
Not good enough for Anna. Anna, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about charter schools. Rod is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Rod. Welcome.
Thank you. I've got a question actually for Mr. Finn, is it?
Yes.
About accountability in charter schools. I go back 5 years with a charter school in Hull. I was a partner to the founder of this particular school. And basically, we have challenged the school. We've become essentially critics of the school, of this particular school, but of the charter school system in Massachusetts in general, for lack of accountability, both academically and fiscal. The academic accountability, I think, is illustrated by the use of, in the South Shore Charter Schools instance, of a CAT test that indicated achievement 3 grade levels above that of the peers in the South Shore. But when the MCAS came out, also the Iowa, it indicated quite the opposite, that the results were, as you pointed out earlier, very mediocre. Also, the fiscal situation is such that we called a state audit on the school, and the auditor found over $1 million unjustifiable in terms of sloppy record keepings for the most part. But we also were, and we are in court even as we speak, on issues that amount to really criminal fraud. All of the charter schools that started in Massachusetts, with the exception of 2, were awarded their charters. Well, I guess one turned it in, and more recently another school just turned theirs in. What states have a charter school program that, in Mr. Finn's estimation, have the best accountability, both academically and fiscally?
Interesting question. Rod, thank you. Chester Finn.
Well, let me come out four square against criminal fraud. I think that this would be a bad thing for any school, public, private, charter, you name it. Charter schools typically are accountable in 2 directions. They're accountable to their clients in the sense of, does anybody want to come to them? They can close or shrink because people don't want to attend them. It's a marketplace accountability. Then they are also accountable to the body that issued them their charter. In Massachusetts, for the most part, that's the State Board of Education, which issued them their charter. And in their charter, they've said what they will produce by way of results in what period of time. And it, typically around the country, that's a 5-year period. And usually it includes academic measures like test scores. It also usually includes other things that the school sets out to do for kids, whether it's turn them into creative beings or make sure they attend every day or recover dropouts or you name it. But this is written right into the charter, and then the charter is supposed to be renewed by the public body at the end of the trial period if, in fact, the goals were substantially met. If there are terrible disasters in between, schools can have the plug pulled earlier than the end of their 5-year charter. If you look around the country today, 60-some charter schools have closed or been closed out of the 1,700 or so that ever opened. In other words, about 4% of American charter schools so far have closed or been closed for a multitude of reasons, ranging from the fact that nobody wanted to come to them to fiscal shenanigans to a failure to deliver a high-quality educational product. I think, as he was saying, I think 1 or maybe 2 of the Massachusetts charter schools have closed or had their charters not renewed so far. In Arizona, there are a couple of dozen charter
schools.
Can
I just ask Michael, Mr. Finn, the whole idea of charter schools is that just the threat of going out of business and the fact that people have chosen to come there in the first place should make the thing a whole lot more responsive for parents, getting attention, being heard. Are you prepared to sort of guarantee that to the parents of your kids?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple other mechanisms. In Massachusetts, it's hard to get a charter. Last year, there were 31 teams from across the state that were competing for five charters, the right to open a school, and we were one of those five, which varies a lot state by state. Massachusetts is probably the toughest state to get a charter, or one of the toughest. The other piece is, in addition to having these, you know, the mobility of parents and that parents can leave, just to respond to the previous caller, I guess two elements. One is parents have been pretty happy at charter schools in Massachusetts. Very few have left the school so far, and the waiting lists have only gotten longer. But one of the interesting things that the last caller raised, and they have a very interesting political personal dispute going on down there, but founders do struggle with the startup, like any young company. One of the things that one of my trustees was telling me, he's a venture capitalist, he said, Mike, when you hire this principal and he effectively becomes the CEO of your school and he's making day-to-day decisions, you have to be prepared that it's going to be hard for you. You're going to have conflicts. And I think all of the charter schools have gone through this initial period in a positive way, I think, but just working out, well, people have different visions of what the school is going to be. And, you know, my focus is relentlessly on getting everybody prepared to succeed in college, and someone else, you know, might agree with that in principle, but how you get there and the manifestations of what decisions you make, who do you hire, who do you fire, all those kinds of decisions there will be, and there are always disagreements with at charter schools, and the fights tend to end up in public.
1-800-423-8255, charter schools in the eighth year of their life around Massachusetts and the country. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Peter is on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Peter.
As a parent from a town where a lot of kids don't go to the public schools, somewhere between 30% and 50%, depending on who you ask, I have a couple of reflections on what parents are looking for in schools, and I think the issue of small schools is one. Another would be parental involvement. In our town where we're building new, larger schools, the parents are very concerned that they won't have the direct input that they've had now in the smaller elementary schools. And I suspect this would go for charter schools as well. I'm kind of curious if your guests could elaborate more on how they encourage parental involvement in their schools. But I'd also like to offer a third thing, and that's the charter schools that we looked at. That one in Somerville was one. There was another one in Malden, which used to be run by the same people, but I think they've also left there. And some others, a lot of them have seemed to reflect a feeling of regimentation and a sort of a basic policy of aiming toward a better performance on standardized tests, perhaps to show that they can do a better job with the local student body than the public schools can. And I suspect that that hasn't borne out in terms of the results, that they perhaps have not been any more successful than the public schools have been, maybe different but not necessarily more successful on the tests. But I wonder whether this idea of regimentation, this idea of pushing kids harder, I think as your guest Mr. Goldstein has alluded to, is really the way that everyone wants to go. One of our kids right now is being homeschooled, and one of the characteristics of the homeschool population is that the children are allowed to do work more at their own pace, and also in more depth rather than breadth on a variety of subject materials, so that in the course of a week or a month or a year, they may not cover as many subjects as their public school contemporaries would, but they'd have an opportunity to explore them.
Peter, let's sum that up. I mean, you're asking Michael about regimentation and homeschooling. You're listening to The Connection. Michael, what about regimentation? Did he pick that up rightly from you, that that's part of your agenda?
I don't know that I would say regimentation is part of our agenda. When we talk to kids and to parents, we essentially offer them this trade-off of you do a lot more work and school becomes a lot more interesting. The parent side of it is really interesting. When we had our lottery back in November, we drew 80 names out of a hat at random, and that night and the day after, we called all the parents and said, congratulations, you won the lottery. What do you want from this school? And parents said three things. First, they said, you know, no one's ever asked me what I wanted from a school before. Second, they said, I want you to know my kid. I think the hunger among parents is that they feel that there are people who, from the parents' point of view, basically know what they're doing, who have a lot of good ideas on how to educate their kids, who actually know each individual child. And the third thing that parents want, and this goes back to your caller from Somerville, is I do think that they really respond to smallness equaling safety. And that's something that we provide at the Somerville Nisabis School, and this is a fissure that Mr. Finn is writing about in the charter school movement. There are for-profits that tend to be big because they need economies of scale, and they have their own ways of trying to solve the problems that size creates. All the other schools, the nonprofits, like most of the schools in Massachusetts, tend to be small. And when you're small, you create a family that allows you to really know this kid likes X, Y, and Z, and if we take advantage of that and we know that, we can get her interested in a particular subject that otherwise she's not really interested in.
We're talking about chartered schools. In the second wave of the movement, Shirley is calling from upstate New York.
Good morning.
Welcome, Shirley.
I really want to give a lecture on why we should be supporting our public schools, but this is not the place. I think that the children are all our children, and that the quality of life in a community depends on the education of its citizens, all of its citizens. So as a former teacher, I'm profoundly sad about the division that's happening here. And this leads me to a specific question for Mr. Finn and perhaps the rest of you also. Are most of the charter school founders acting from a positive idea, like they're saying this is the way a school really should be run, or are most of them reacting from the fact that they view the public school situation as being hopeless? That would be my first question.
Well, in their setting, in their community, in their town, they typically feel that the kind of school they think ought to exist doesn't now exist. And they set out to create something which is significantly different from whatever is the prevailing norm of the traditional public schools and, incidentally, private schools in their immediate vicinity. That's why charter schools end up so varied, so different from each other. If you're in a school, in a community where the basic norm is a kind of old-fashioned back-to-basics education, your charter school may end up being a very progressivist, constructivist school, but vice versa. If you're in a progressive community, you may set up a back-to-basics school because you feel that's what kids and families crave, and at least some of them do, and that it's not otherwise available in their community. It's not just reacting against, it's also a positive vision of what ought to be, and the charter mechanism allows people to try to realize that vision.
Shirley, did you have another question?
Yes, I did. For those people who are reacting to the fact that they feel that it's kind of hopeless in the public schools, has anyone thought of or advocated a way to improve the public schools that would use this energy of these people who are going off and founding charter schools? Because, as I said earlier, it makes me very, very sad because I think a lot of the children, in fact, I would say in my situation, if I hadn't had a really good public school, I don't think I would be the person I am today.
Shirley, it's a point well taken. Chester Finn?
Well, certainly there are many efforts underway all over the country to reform the public schools as well. There's standards, there's accountability, there's new curricula, there's technology, and there's a lot of energy going into this, a lot of money going into this as well. The people who are setting out to start charter schools generally are motivated a little bit differently. They want to start something fresh, start something from scratch. I think it's a pretty exciting development.
That's you, Michael Goldstein. I mean, I keep wanting to ask, has anybody ever made money on these so-called private for-profit schools, and is that even the remotest part of your ambition?
Not any part of our ambition. I don't think I have some issues with that model. I don't see that the balance sheets are going to work out in the long term. And I would respond by saying charter schools are public schools. They're free for parents. Parents go to them.
You can learn more about Michael Goldstein School on his webpage at www.matchschool.org. Michael Goldstein, good luck. And Chester, Chester Finn, thanks very, very much for your work and for finally joining us on The Connection. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. What do frogs, Maine fishing lakes, teenagers, and the Pirates of Penzance have in common? They're all the subject of stories coming up with all the news.